Welcome to Books, Stories, People with me, Nancy Richards. Highly respected artist and founder of the Putter School, Andrew Putter's creative output reflects not just in his work, which can be witnessed around the world, as well as in Cape Town's leading art institutions, but in his extremely fertile thought process. His most recent project has quite literally grown out of the sandy soil of the Cape Flats. His inspiration? The indigenous but very threatened Cape Flats sand fynbos. It's still in its early stages of development, but I sat with him outside to find out more about the growth of this project and to hear where his life as an artist began.
I studied art in the 80s at Michaelis, and so my art education was quite conventional. I studied painting and illustration, actually, and started becoming interested in this late 80s in artworks that were perhaps more difficult to define. I started collaborating. I was sort of one of the first people that I know of in my generation to work collaboratively in the city. And the first big collaboration I did, I worked with Tracy Payne. We did some collaborations at the Baxter Gallery, some big paintings together, which we made in front of people. And then Leonard Shapiro suggested that we ask Xerox to sponsor us a couple of copying machines. And again, we took the Baxter Gallery and we spent a couple of weeks photocopying things and then making a book out of the photocopies and an exhibition out of the things that we photocopied. And those things were pressed onto the wall. They were kind of cut out into these sort of collage-y, large collages that were one-offs that weren't... They were temporary, so when they were taken down, they were destroyed in a sense. So that kind of collaborative work and working with media that in those days weren't traditional media was the sort of beginning, really, of my work as a professional artist. And then in the 90s, I started getting more and more concerned by what I saw as kind of problems in the art world, one of which was that you make these art objects that you've got to guard with your life because if you touch them, they're going to break, or they need to, you know, they're impossible to transport because they're so heavy or so big, and so it's expensive to transport them abroad if you want to sell abroad, or if you want to exhibit them, you've got to exhibit them for 3 weeks, so you've got to find somebody to look after the gallery for 3 weeks, so you've got to rent a space. You make the work by yourself, you don't have company, it all happens as a sort of solo author. And so I started to make work that critiqued that, and the work that I made was, I worked with Andre Forster, the architect, and we made a party, actually. It was the final form that the project took, called the MCQP, which looked at all of those questions, and so it brought together a large group of local people, young people and old people, working across disciplines to make a one-night event in which they not only made the decor, we used the River Club, which was an extensive building in those days, beautiful for a party with lots of different dance floors, then made the decor, but they also made costumes and came in disguise. And it dealt with sexual difference and sexual orientation. This was at a time when it was still illegal to be gay, and the constitution had just changed, and we thought, okay, now is the time that we need to bring gay people and straight people, this was the kind of binaristic way we sort of thought in those days, together, and make things together. And so that was a kind of a really powerful way of starting to recognize that an artwork can actually be anything. It can be an event. I then did a lot of work in public space. I was a director of a company called Public Eye. There were a group of seven of us, Sue Williamson, Brett Murray, Kevin Brand, Lisa Bryce, various others. And we supported public art around the city. So we were a body that people could put final funding through. But often we did projects of our own as well. And those would be, they could be signage or they could be temporary sculptures. Brett Murray, for example, and Kevin Brand ran a fabulous project called PTO, where they invited artists to temporarily mess with public sculpture for a day. I think it was on Heritage Day, I can't remember, and the most incredible things happened. BZ Bailey, for example, took the statue of outside Parliament of
Louis Botha.
Of Louis Botha on his horse, and he turned him into an amaqueta, which was just so made his face white, and put a blanket around his shoulders, and he looked like a young person, a young closer person on a horse. For a day, of course. So, you know, when I talk about being an artist and talk about working with art as a field in which to produce things, the forms which my work could possibly take and have taken are as varied as there are things in life. You know, from the beginning of the 20th century, it was kind of decided in the art world that anything could be art if you wanted it to be. And so there was this wide open field to use any potential form. So a PowerPoint presentation to a group of suburbanites who are gardeners and that want to know more about how to make their garden could be conceived of as an artwork. So it could work as a presentation, but one could also draw on the resources and the histories and the world of art to infuse that project with things that make it add more dimensions to it, that make it even richer than it would be if it were just a presentation.
So from what you're saying, it sounds potentially like anybody could be an artist. Would you dare define what makes an artist? Could you do that?
No, those are not questions that I could answer. I think that anybody could be an artist, but I think that most people that to be an artist, I think that it depends on what you mean by that in very concrete terms. So if you say that you're an artist, a person might ask, why do you say that? You know, what is the benefit of saying that you're an artist? And how does that affect what you do? And there are many different art worlds, and the different art worlds aren't necessarily connected, and someone can be very powerful in one art world or very famous or highly regarded and not be known in another art world. And so very often as a practicing artist, someone will say to me like, oh, do you know so-and-so? And they're somebody who maybe sells paintings for 300,000 rand and I will never have heard of them. And then I will say, oh, do you know so-and-so? And I'll mention someone that I know from the art worlds that I happen to be connected to. And they'll say like, oh, no, I've never heard of that person. So that's a good thing to understand, is that when someone is an artist and that affects what they do and it's part of their way of being in the world and making a living perhaps, or affecting people or being affected by things, then that's concrete. That's not an abstract thing, and it relates to what social worlds you're working in and what who you're connected to, not in a good or bad way, but just in different ways.
But as an artist yourself, then, you are one of the things that seems to me to define you as an artist, is that you're very, very hyper aware of your surroundings. Would I be right?
Yes. So I decided when I was very young, I was in my early teens, that I was going to learn to love what was immediately around me. I grew up in Pinelands, and Pinelands was a hellhole in the late 70s and early 80s. It was if you were a kind of creative gay kid growing up in a place like that, at a time like that, cultural boycotts, apartheid, in this kind of very straight, kind of culturally funneled, I mean, I'm not quite sure what the right vocabulary is, but it just wasn't a good place to grow up. It didn't support creativity. Boys played sport and girls wore dresses, and I wanted to wear dresses and I didn't want to play sport, which is not the case anymore. But, you know, at a time like that, when those were the only options, it seemed like the best thing to do was just to, you know, not the best thing, the only thing was to kind of rebel and want the opposite. And then I came across some wonderful reading. I read a lot as a child, and in the Pinelands Library, which was a great library, there was some writing by Chinese authors, and there was some Taoist writing, and one of the Chinese Taoist writers had spoken about, you know, how one can know the universe from a grain of sand. It's like that old phrase that, as you know, many people know. And it was the first time I'd come across it, and I was very young and impressionable. I was 13 or 14, and it really struck a chord, and I thought, wow, like, I actually don't need to go anywhere. I don't need to go abroad. I don't need to go to Joburg, which was the only other option in those days if you were sort of culturally interesting. I can stay here. I can stay in this kind of godforsaken suburb that's got sandy soil and where the wind blows and where pine trees, invasive pine trees, I don't know if they're invasive, but they're certainly not indigenous. Pine trees have been planted that smother all other kinds of life. But I can find a way to make that something that becomes necessary to my life as a person and as a creative person. And so from when I was very young, I'd kind of, in a sense, recognized how much easier that would be. It seemed so much more resourceful than needing to find that stimulus elsewhere. And there's so much around us all the time. You know, one can sit in an empty room and still be constantly, if one remembers to keep coming back to what is actually happening, both in oneself and what is around one, and one's threshold is lowered, one can be constantly surprised by things.
Which kind of brings me to your surroundings, which you're very conscious of your urban surroundings, your suburban surroundings, which is why we're sitting here in a suburban situation. But more recently, you've become very conscious of the growing surroundings, and I think you've become very conscious of the Cape Flats sand fynbos, which seems unusual for an artist, I think. But tell me how you first came across that and what it has said to you.
Yeah, so this is my big passion at the moment. About 3 months ago in summer, I was on a summer break and I was very relaxed and I thought I'll take a bicycle ride to Pinelands. I live in Rondebosch. And I thought I'll just cycle around Pinelands, good old boring Pinelands. And it was a beautiful hot day and I kind of cycled around under the shade of the pines. I was thankful for that shade. And one of the things I was looking at is I was looking at what was growing there. I've always been interested in plants. I'm not a gardener, so I don't have that knowledge, but I have spent a lot of time looking at plants and walking amongst them in the wild and reading about them and making artworks about them. And I was looking at the gardens and I was thinking, you know, this sandy soil. So you look at Pinelands and people are always complaining about their sandy soils. It's like sand. Water runs off it. You know, it's got no nourishment in it. And I'm just going to wait for this. Is it an aeroplane? Is it a helicopter flying over? Yay for the suburbs. I think it's a helicopter. Yeah, all this interesting life coming from outside of the suburbs.
It's intruding itself. It's insinuating itself into the sound.
Only momentarily. See, there it goes again. I had a sense, because I've always been, well, not for always, but for at least the last 20, 25 years, been interested in indigenous planting. I'd come across that idea. Andre Forster, who I did MCQP with, he was the first person to introduce me to the idea that we should be planting indigenous plants because they grow more easily in the place where you're planting them. Often they need less water. They bring the right kind of wildlife, insects, birds, small mammals that are suited to that location because they've been growing there for millions of years. And so they're part of like very complex ecologies that when you start to plant them, they start to revive those ecologies or connect other bits of that ecology that are growing. So I sort of had that idea in my head. So I was riding around Pinelands looking at these gardens. And of course, most of the gardens in Pinelands, as in many of the suburbs where people have resources, is that one is seeing lawn and roses and often plants that remind, for example, if it's an English-speaking neighborhood and people have English ancestry, often there can be a link to England a century and a half ago. Well, a century ago, so 1820s. And so those are what people would have grown up with. And then there's this kind of sense of nostalgia and a connection to that aesthetic because of what it reminds one of in terms of one's family and stuff. All very beautiful. So that's often those kind of gardens can predominate in a place like Pinelands. In the sand, those plants are not really suited to sand. You know, they often want lots of water, and Pinelands is very dry, and they don't like the wind, and Pinelands is very windy, etc., etc. So I'm riding around, looking at the gardens, and not really seeing anything where anyone's planted anything. Not a lot of indigenous stuff. There's not very much. And I cycle over back home, and I cycle past Rondebosch Common. And Rondebosch Common, strangely, is a place that I haven't really visited much, even though I live very close to it. And I cycled past the signboard for it, which is very amazing. It's kind of got lots of information, lovely pictures and easy text to read and stuff. And it said something like, this bit of ground conserves... One of the things that it conserves is Cape Flats sand fynbos. And then I think it described a bit what Cape Flats sand fynbos was. And it said this is a critically endangered felt type. Only 1% is conserved. And it could disappear very easily, the plants that belong to it, and that this is one of that 1% is on Rondebosch Common. So that means that there used to be 99% of it somewhere on the Cape Flats. And the Cape Flats here means the sandy soil that Pinelands has. Anyone that has that sandy soil that Pinelands has is on the Cape Flats. So it's not a political or civic designation. It's a geologic designation. It has to do with soil. So when you look at the peninsula and you divide it in half, so if you look at the peninsula with Table Mountain on one side and the Hottentots Holland on the other, and you divide it in half east to west, it means that the half that is on the side of False Bay, that kind of sand is is a different kind of sand. That sand has shells in it. But the sand, the other half, which goes from more or less Mowbray or Pinelands to Cryfontein, that's on the sort of Table Bay side of the peninsula, that whole side is Cape Flat soil. And it goes all the way down to Tokai, actually, and zigzagging across other kinds of soil. So it means that basically what I learned when I read the signboard and started to understand as I did more research, it's that for millions of years, species of plants evolved and developed and emerged evolutionarily here on the peninsula and on the mountain and etc. That grew together for millions of years with very complex ecologies of mammals and birds and insects and various bacteria and fungi and all kinds of things. And now those are under severe threat. So Cape Town is the United Nations describes Cape Town as the most biodiverse city in the world. So we are the most biodiverse city in the world. And Cape Flat sand fynbos, which are the kinds of plants that would have grown in the sand all the way from Pinelands through to the Hottentots Holland, were a big slice of that biodiversity pie. The United Nations also calls us the most, we've lost the most plants. We're the most threatened city in the world. We're losing plants very quickly to extinction. And because so little is conserved, and because obviously we're building and stuff, which we have to, because, you know, human beings need to survive and stuff, so there are these very real pressures that we can't avoid. It means that this biodiversity is being lost. Seeing that and realizing that this little bit of land that I'd never really looked at, Rondebosch Common, was one of the places where this exquisitely rich biodiversity was being conserved, like on my doorstep, came as such a shock. And it prompted, as I read it, something very deep started to shift in me, and I knew that a big project was beginning to unfold. And I didn't quite trust myself. I sort of thought I better not commit myself, but I said, okay, I'm going to give myself maybe the rest of the year, 2021, just to kind of research and speak to people and visit plants and just visit sites where Cape Flat sand fynbos has been conserved and other related sites, and then just see after a year like how things are going, and then maybe start some kind of quite big project or series of projects that relate to this as a thematic. And so one of the things that I discovered is when we're planting in our gardens, and I'm very interested in suburban life. I've always lived in suburbs and I absolutely love being in a suburb. I think there are many compensations to being in a suburb, and one of the things is that sometimes people have access to gardening space. It means they can grow things, and that's a real privilege if one has that, and one is not forced by necessity to have to grow food, which of course is also a great thing to be growing. But if one has a space, either public space or a bit of one's own garden space, to start to plant the plants that would have grown in that place 100 years ago or 50 years ago or 1,000 years ago or a million years ago, I mean, that's how much continuity there is in terms of what would grow here. I'm interested in what would one plant in one's gardens in different suburbs in Cape Town, and it depends on where you move around Cape Town. I mean, the Cape Flats, including Tokai and Pinelands and parts of Claremont, would be one set of plants generally. But then, of course, moving over to the Muesenberg, Philippi, Khayelitsha side would be another whole set of plants. The mountain would be another set of plants. The city bowl would be another set of plants. And I'm speaking very broadly now. And I always used to think that those were called biomes, but biome, apparently that's not the right term. Biome is an abstraction that describes all of those different types under one big umbrella, but it doesn't distinguish between them. So the term that I've learned one can use is a term called felt type. And felt type is really what I'm becoming increasingly interested in. And Cape Flats sand fynbos is a felt type. Another felt type, for example, where I live in Rondebosch, that the little bit of garden that I can be working in sits in, is called Table Mountain Shale Rhenosterfelt. So Table Mountain because it's on Table Mountain, shale because that's the soil comes from shale, which is a soft rock that the mountain produced, a sand, and Rhenosterfelt, which is a kind of set of kinds of plants, which I think are also conserved on Rondebosch Common, if I'm not mistaken. I think it's also some conservation of that felt type there. So that's really changed my way of looking at things. So when I'm cycling around the suburbs, which I do a lot of now, I'm looking at people's gardens and looking at little wild spaces in corners of places where things have just come up on their own accord, or following rivers, or visiting tiny little reservation sites that are being little conserved in different parts of the Cape Flats and around the mountain. My eye has become increasingly over the last couple of months attuned to recognizing when a plant that particular plant would probably have been there a million years ago, whereas the plant next to it might have been a little bit further up the mountain a million years ago. And I'm not good at it, but it's become extremely exciting to be able to see the world in this new way and to look at plants in terms of their ecology. Where is home for them? And then to think about that in relation to our suburbs and how to plant in our suburbs so that we create these corridors of connected biodiversity that allow these different plants and animals and insects and fungi and soil bacteria to all interconnect with one another and to start to sustain each other. Oh, there's another aeroplane flying overhead. Oh, life in the suburbs. I wonder where that's come from and where that one's going to. You see, it's amazing. We're sitting in Rondebosch, and flying above our heads is perhaps something connecting us to London or to Germany or to Tokyo or to Johannesburg in this little place.
It sounds like you have a huge amount to deal with for all the things that you've described, your heightened consciousness around Cape Flats, this felt type that you've been describing. It sounds like there's a huge amount of work to be done in just researching, from what you're saying. And then what? I mean, at what stage are you at with your research? And where do you hope for this to go? Because this wouldn't be the first time that you have used indigenous growth as an inspiration. I think you've done a whole series prior to this. So where are you at with your research? And where is this project going to go in tangible terms?
Oh, that's a good question. I couldn't tell you. You know, the research phase of projects is my favorite phase. I'm sort of a born researcher. I absolutely love finding things out, and especially connecting to people, speaking to experts and finding out what they know, and speaking to people across different fields and putting the knowledge together. In terms of outputs, I don't think that there are going to be outputs this year. I should think 2022 would probably be the soonest that there will be outputs. And the sort of outputs that are kind of drifting through my head as possibilities, one would be a book. I think some kind of a handbook for people, you know, that could sit on in the gardening section of a bookshop. Is one possibility that gives people very concrete ideas about what to do. You've got a garden, you live in the Cape Town, around Cape Town somewhere, and maybe there's a way of making this something that actually could, that people all around the world could use. You know, maybe it's not felt type specific so much as a set of tools that allow you to find out what your felt type is, no matter where you live in the world, even if you're in Antarctica. You know, what are the There's either a fungus or a bacteria. I think a fungus that grows in Antarctica. So there's a felt type there, presumably. You know, like, what is that? Anyway, so a book would be one thing. And then, you know, when I'm sitting and dreaming and fantasizing about making a book, which of course may not happen, but I think, okay, so what would it be called? And then I thought, it could be called something like Don't Plant Indigenous. You know, that could have sort of put a cat amongst the pigeons. And then the subtitle would be something like Lessons from the Cape Flat Sand Fynbos, which would be around, if you're going to plant indigenous, which of course is a great idea, then try to find the felt type so that when we're working with the idea of indigenousness, we don't work with too broad and abstract an idea of indigenousness. Because if, you know, when I, like maybe 6 months ago, I would have thought that a plant like Pride of the Cape, which is I think it's a high felt plant, that would be an appropriate plant to put in my garden. But it might not be, because it's not from this felt type. Bizarrely, actually, on the Cape Flats, there are no trees in the Cape Flats sand fynbos, which doesn't mean that there aren't trees on the margins and sometimes in kind of tall shrubs and low trees in wetlands, like the Soralia, which some of you will know from Rondebosch Common. It's a fountain bush which smells like, it has little purple flowers and it smells like grape Kool-Aid. In America, I think it's called grape Kool-Aid bush or something, tree. But yeah, just getting back to that question of what would the outputs be, another one would be a series of pictures. I'm drawing a lot. I'm working digitally quite a lot. I'm making vector drawings. I've been very inspired by Pierre Pinard's work. He's an old friend who's a kind of a designer who works internationally on very exciting projects. And he recently published a book called Afro Surf, which is about surfing in Africa and about the history of surfing in Africa. And he illustrated it and worked with photographers and writers. And it's just very, very inspiring visually. And that's been sitting in the back of my head a lot in this project, just the way that that looks. It's very fresh and futuristic. And it's, you know, as one person, a horticulturalist that I spoke to recently, he said, I hate botanical art. It's kind of boring and twee and dull and conservative. And of course, that's true on one hand. On another hand, when you get into it, it's also very beautiful. At the same time, I think that I would quite like to make an image culture or a series of images around the Cape Flats Sand Fynbos project that maybe present these plants or the life of these plants or the people that are connected to these plants in a way that's much more contemporary and you know, that maybe connects to contemporary music culture or cartoon culture, or I haven't started that research yet, but just something that doesn't look familiar.
So I'm guessing that, or at least I'm assuming that the one of the jobs of an artist is to bring a message across to your observer, whoever it is that's witnessing your artwork, one way or another. The book idea is a very literal one, quite literally literal one, in as much as people could pick it up and say, oh, I get this, I see what's being told to me here. But the other way of doing it, which is to present a certain set of visuals that will pique people's interest, trigger people's interest, seems to be more perhaps the way that you might go. I'm interested in the fact that you are doing quite a lot of drawings, vector drawings. I'm not sure what vector drawings are. But how is it, aside from what you're taking in visually yourself and the result of your reading and your talking to people, how is it manifesting now? Have you done any drawings of these little plants?
Yes. No, I draw. I mostly draw every day. I do a bit of drawing or creative work every day. And so I've been drawing flowers and leaves, either from life or from photographs. I've been taking lots of photographs as well.
So the project has sort of already begun. I mean, even the journey to get to wherever it's going to be is already part of it, yes?
Yes, very definitely. You know, it feels to me as though I'm in the middle of the beginning of the project. And I should think that by spring, by September, I should be like very much in the beginning, you know, beginning to actually move into the sort of the beginning, you know, the beginning of the middle of the project. But I have a feeling that it's going to be a few years of work, and that there won't just be one output, and that it won't necessarily all just be me, that there might be a fair amount of collaborative work. I'm hoping very much to find other people that are creative, that make things, and to work with, that are inspired by the same kind of world, the world of felt types, particularly the world of Cape Flats Sand Fynbos, but any felt type of the city would be fine. But anybody that works creatively, fashion designers, 3D designers, architects, horticulturalists, book designers, graphic designers, painters, musicians, anybody that makes things and that has a making practice, that is already good at making things. And making things is a central part of how they define themselves and what they do with their lives. If those people have an interest in locally endemic and indigenous plants in Cape Town, I would love to meet with those people and start to find out what they're busy with and see if there aren't ways in which our work can align and maybe even become collaborative at time to produce things that I hope will be in the broader global world of culture, things that change people's minds about things, create new historical possibilities for being in the world and being with each other and being with plants, you know.
So what you describe is more of a movement than a single exhibition, as it were, traditionally to go on the walls of an art gallery. So over and above the end product, whatever it may be, whatever that thing may look like or feel like, it's something that would be quite important to the Cape area historically and going forward into the future, because, as you say, people need to live here, but we need to protect what we have. Is there any way in which you could work with any of the departments? I mean, how broad is your reach of getting people on board with this?
Yeah, all of those things are possible. You know, for a few years I worked with Cape Town Partnership, and I did a lot of one of the what did you call them, sets of stakeholders that I worked with were people in city. I don't so much like working with government personally, so I'm not saying that it couldn't become part of, you know, I think people in local government are doing very important work, and there will be people in local government that are actually doing some of this conservation work. You know, I think that there's very exciting stuff happening. I'm just not super aware of it. But it's not really where my interest lies, working with people in that world, because often it can become very complex, and it can also sometimes be work that's very slow, and it's also sometimes quite politicized. And so it's kind of tied to the cycles of kind of voting cycles and things. And yeah, I just haven't given that much thought. So.
And the antithesis, perhaps, of what an artist, the direction an artist may be moving in. So if anybody would like to join this movement, to find out more, to maybe see some of your drawings even, how can they find you? Have you got a website?
The best way to get hold of me would be to actually just drop me a line. And the way to do that would be to WhatsApp me. And I'm going to just give you my number slowly. It's 076-563-9540. And my email address is my name, Andrew Putter. That's P-U-T-T-E-R. @gmail.com, just straightforward. And people are absolutely welcome to drop me a line. Just say hi, what they're busy with, you know, and yeah, we make a connection from there. I'd absolutely welcome that.
Well, I, for one, would love to be part of the movement. Andrew Putter, thank you so much.
Thank you, Nancy.